Hello and welcome back to Kitchen Curiosity, the podcast that delves into food service equipment and the world of hospitality. I'm your host, Radford Chancellor, and today we're turning down the heat and turning down the temperature with two fantastic guests from different sides of the platform talking about kitchen refrigeration and cold room specifically. Joining me, I've got Chris John, who's executive chef of Nisbets National Catering Equipment Centre, a man who's seen it all in the kitchen and now trains, advises, inspires chefs and operators around the country. I'll also be joined by Gary Allitt, who's a national sales manager at Williams Refrigeration. He specialises and focuses on the cold rooms and most important part of your kitchen, and probably a bit we don't really talk about. And at the end of the podcast, I'm going to bring them both together. So without much further ado, and we're actually in the studio in London today. Chris, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Good, good. An eventful journey, but you're here.
I'm here at last, so the story can continue.
And the room's quite cold.
Yes, nice. So it's quite apt for what the topic is today with Gary.
Exactly. I'm putting it down like minus. No, it's all 18 degrees, which is quite chilly. But so anyway, for the listeners, Chris, do you want to give us a bit about your history, how you became a chef, and how you got into food service equipment?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name's obviously Chris John, so I'm the chef for Nisbets. I look after the group.
Yeah.
But yeah, started off really not as a chef. So a lot of people obviously think I want to be a chef, so they train to be a chef. But I sort of fell into it by accident. So I actually went to university to do something completely different with the automotive world and design. And then during your time off as a student, I guess you get your freedom a lot more within university coming from school. So you get the chance to obviously earn some money because you like to spend it on certain things we won't mention too much about.
Yeah.
So what we do then is I had a job with my auntie, actually. She was running a pub at the time. Mm-hmm. So I used to help her on the bar. So just easy money, okay, social, happy days. One day they were short in the kitchen and said, any chance you could give us a hand in the kitchen? I said, I don't really know what I'm doing, but yeah, fine. I like cooking. I'm a rather large gentleman, should we say. So I enjoy the food side of stuff. So went into the kitchen and from there it sort of evolved. So my first actual job in the kitchen was putting the meat for the Sunday roast on the plate. So I'd look at the check coming in and say, well, one chicken, put the chicken on the plate, pass it over to the chef. So that was literally my first job in the kitchen. From that I've sort of evolved and went on to more stuff. So then started in the pot washers, a lot of the good chefs do, and then earning your way around the kitchen and learning different areas of the kitchen as well and what that job entails. Mm-hmm. From there, then I thought, you know what, this is actually, I quite enjoy this. I'm finding it quite easy, should I say. Should it be this difficult? Should it be this easy? So from there, then I went into a restaurant setting down in West Wales, whereby then started sort of learning properly, should we say. So it's from sort of getting in the kitchen as a hobby and just doing basket meals and things like that for a pub and Sunday roast.
Really getting into proper meals.
Really getting into cooking, proper cooking, creating sauces and, starting from scratch. And the place was very good. So they used to have, basically the sort of rule was if we didn't have the physical time to make it, we'd have to buy it in, but everything else had to be made from scratch. So everything from the bread in the morning to we'd butchery, the fishmonger would deliver every day from the harbour, that sort of stuff. So it really sort of delved into your core skills. And then from there was then the training aspect. So you'd do on-course training where you'd go to the classroom for once a day, and then the assessor would come out to your site of work and sort of teach you how to assess
you on different things. That's kind of your formal qualifications.
Exactly that, and that's where you get your formal stuff, and then you have to check you can fillet a fish and so on and so forth and sign you off on your modules. And then from there then the place I was working had three very good restaurants, so I managed to bounce between the three and then lots of information from different chefs, which was great because I find anybody you speak to, certainly in the culinary world, whether it be a kind of equipment side or whether it be from a culinary side, somebody will teach you something new, and that information is invaluable because it's sort of first-hand information that people have learned over the years, which is really great to learn and digest and really take on board because it's sort of a hands-on experience rather than just the textbooks telling me I need to do it like this. But there's always tricks of the trade, there's always shortcuts which we chefs try to get on and make sure we're using them as best as we can. Anyway, roll on a few years then. Long story short, my partner was training university, so I moved up to be with her in Bristol, and then bounced around a few jobs up here across different areas of the UK, and then moved into the MOD.
Okay.
So we were working for contract catering within the MOD sector. Yep. So bouncing again between sites in the southwest, doing catering from anything from a three-star general dine out for maybe 10, 15 people right up to, 1,000 plus, catering for large events and stuff for things going on around the country. So then that sort of taught me a different area from mass catering down to fine dining and everything in between.
Yeah.
And that's where I sort of rised up to the ranks then of head chef and then exec chef and chef manager and so on, where you sort of went up and got your stripes, so to speak, within the military world. And then off the back of that, also dipping hands into private stuff as well, you know, doing sort of functions and dine outs and event catering and things like that, which was really good. From there, thought, you know what, done this now for 10 plus years, let's look at a change. And then just randomly one day, just saw the advert pop up on one of the sites at the time for Nisbet's executive development chef. I said, oh, what's a development chef? What do they do? That sounds interesting. What are they developing? Some recipes, what's going on? And I didn't really know much about that side of things at the time, because you were always stuck in your bubble, really. So from there, I sort of looked into it and thought, you know what, these could, you know, we've always bought from Nisbet's, but these guys are actually a lot bigger than I thought. They're not just a catalogue that's propping the door open. It's actually a lot of information going on. So yeah, long story short again, a few interviews later, and here I am, sort of in
so
that world.
Literally from the hospitality sector into the food service equipment.
Exactly. So I remember one of the questions on the form for the filling in for the job was, do you know much about catering equipment? I'm like, well, yes, I do. I use it every day. I know exactly what a six burner is and a grill is, and I know what a fryer is. But little did I know is so much more to it. Sort of a bit of naive going into it, thinking,
yeah,
and just throwing all these terms out and stuff. I was like, oh, I don't really know what I'm doing. Yeah, but after obviously learning and, you know, speaking for people like Gary and learning what they do and going around the much broader catering industry, then becomes quite natural once you understand it from that culinary point, rather than a sort of a design or a user point. It's more from like a chef using it. So does it do what exactly it says on the tin? What's right for the right customer? And that's where it ties in with Nisbet's as such, and becomes a
your role with the Nisbet's, what is it you're doing?
So it's quite varied, and to be honest, it's sort of changed over the years. So I've been there now 6 years, coming up to in September. And it sort of started off as you're the development chef based at the NCEC, which is the National Catering Equipment Centre in Avonmouth in Bristol.
Yeah.
And it was, customers would come in, they'd ask for, I'm looking to buy a deep fat fryer, for argument's sake. And they go, what's right for my business? So I'd look at what they were doing and then demonstrate said piece of kit to them and say, this is the fryer that's really good, sort of would fit your budget, your what you're looking to use it for, power source, all that good stuff. And it's sort of fix your bill. So it's sort of like a try before you buy sort of situation, because you know, catered equipment's not cheap. So we want to, you know, it's like buying a car. You wouldn't go and buy a car with technically without test driving it, in theory. So, you know, why should you have to fork out tens of thousands necessarily on equipment and going, you know, I hope it's right. Because a big thing for me coming from that catering world into the sort of equipment side of things was the fact that the awareness of what's actually out there in the industry. There's so much stuff available, but unless you're in that click, shall we say, you don't know it exists.
Yeah, exactly.
So you just know, I need a fryer, so I've got that.
We don't know what is good and what isn't good.
Exactly that. Yeah. You know, technology moves all the time. You can see that with technology and smartphones and stuff like that. So it's the same in the catering world. You know, what, and the change of what people are looking for now is a massive change from, we sort of pre-COVID, post-COVID seems to be the sort of break in the timeline. You know, that's where we went to digitalize stuff in the kitchen. We invested then heavily in the digital side of the products and training, because people weren't allowed to mingle at the time. And sort of after COVID, so post-COVID, we found it was difficult to get people back into the kitchens. So then it was, we need to look at other stuff now. We need to look at labor saving, what's going to help the customer, energy saving, and all this sort of tick boxes now, which we weren't really looking at beforehand. We were one of the first back into the NCEC during the, you know, furlough stages. And we used, so with like, how can we reach out to customers? I bought a little £10 video card off Amazon, which allowed us then to use the laptop and the camera we had in the kitchen, which was designed for in-house recording, allowed us to get people from the outside to look in. So we started doing these webinars, which people didn't really know much about. We had Zoom. What was Zoom? It was like, we've never heard of this Zoom. And obviously that's now gone on to Teams and so on. But it's just, that was sort of the starting point of then the digitalization. And then
more online.
Exactly that. And this is where customers can now link into the kitchen rather than having to take a day out to travel down to maybe see a demo on a fryer. We can link up, have 20-minute demonstration on the fryer itself, talk interactively through screens. Not as good, because you don't get the taste, touch, feel, and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But if you haven't got the time, or you know, haven't got the availability to take the chefs out of the kitchen, we can link up and do that.
Digitally. See that. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And then, I mean, the NCEC.
Yeah.
What, it's a great setup. What was the sort of vision, or what is the vision behind that? And how old is it? It's moved on a bit, I think.
Yeah, so it's coming up to, it must be about 10 years now. And the idea behind it was Sir Andrew Nisbet and the team decided that they were doing all the exhibitions and stuff, and there's a big cost to that. So they thought, well, let's make our own exhibition centre, which is permanently open 24 hours a day. Every day of the year, obviously, not bank holidays and so on, but that was open all year round.
Okay.
And allowed customers to travel somewhere within the UK and Europe.
And what sort of size is it?
It's a bigger size. exact numbers, I'm not sure. I'll have to look them up. But it's a very...
You have a lot of kit there.
Exactly. So the idea is that the loads of manufacturers are all under one roof. So customers can come down, wander around the stands.
That's open and see, just wander around.
It's open for the public and a trading public to just wander around, see the latest bits of kit. The guys who have the stands, so we've got like Williams, will then change the kit as new stuff comes out. So we try and stay on top of the latest products and so on and so forth. So if people are coming down, they're seeing what's available. But of course, that's only a small... inkling into what's available exactly. So that's where we sort of step in and go, well, you've only got like 4 fryers on display. Yeah, but we've actually listed maybe 144. It's, you know, there's not physically enough room to put everything under one roof. So it's just giving you a touch of feel of the different manufacturers and what they do.
And then staff manning that, I guess, all the time. And
yeah, so we've got a retail team. So there's a full retail shop in there and a big clearance area, which is very, very popular. So that's sort of maybe drop lines or maybe something's been damaged on delivery. So rather than it can't be sold new, it goes back into clearance. And that's sort of a big draw for anybody in the local area and further afield because there's just so much in there. In fact, if my missus stopped me going in there because I keep bringing stuff home, it's like, oh, because when I first arrived, because I was like, so chef back in the day, you always beg, borrow and steal it to get a few quid for maybe a new chopping board or a sieve or something. Yeah. But nowadays, it's, you go into there and it's like a Toys R Us for chefs. You just go around and go, if you stop bringing stuff home. So I was like, okay, sorry. So I'm throwing it back.
Because I guess we all kind of know bits from the, like you said, the catalogue and then the high street shops. So I guess this centre is like a big version of that.
Exactly. It sort of brings it to life, really. Yeah. We do our Nisbets live show now every year, which has started, I think it's on its third, fourth year now coming up. And that's developing and becoming bigger each year. And it allows, sort of brings the event to life. And it, the marketing side of it is dedicated to bring people into the NCC who may or not have been there before and just show the awareness of the centre. And it's one of the only ones you can actually close a deal on the day as well, which is quite interesting because you go to a show, you have to get a, you know, a form, you'd fill out the customer's details and go back to them maybe within 2 or 3 days. Where that trail may have gone cold, they may have spoken to someone else, but with the NCC on the in the show, you can actually close on the day through the tills and have your days. So you've got the...
Okay, so the customer can take away, get the product they want.
Exactly. And, you can take away some stuff on the day, obviously, if you know, or you six burner in your car and your mini, then good luck. But if it's in stock, we can sort of deliver it. Yeah.
So, I mean, just going back to sort of choosing equipment and, you know, when operators look at equipment things, what do you think is one of the biggest things that's missed by chefs or operators when they're looking at equipment?
From experience, it's definitely the awareness of what's available. As I say, the easiest option is always to go like for like. I've got said combi oven, I'm going to go buy another one because it's what I'm used to and I don't like changing it. I know it fits in that hole. I know it's going to plug in happy days.
Yeah.
However, certainly with conversation with customers, there's probably 50-50% of the time they'll ask for something, and after speaking to them, I try and have a sort of a digital consultation before they come into the kitchen.
Yeah,
because at the point they've come into the and really delve into what they're trying to achieve and why they're looking at that piece of kit. Maybe it's from an energy point of view, maybe it's for staff training, maybe it's for something completely different, maybe it's going into a satellite kitchen, whatever. But until you understand their real needs, it's only then you can really advise on what's sort of that best solution for them. And that's where we sort of come in. So the idea is to be the expert or try and be the expert on everything to then pass on that expertise to the customer. So they're making sure they're getting the best value for the money.
Okay.
You know, the amount of times they've asked for something that's maybe 20 or 30 grand, and it's like, you don't really need that. You can do it this a lot simpler and cheaper.
So maybe it's understanding the application that maybe they just think, oh, a fryer's a fryer or a combi's a combi or whatever, but understanding deeper the application and the reasons, I suppose.
Exactly, and it's we're under no, you know, not on a sales target, for instance, so we're not trying to push any particular brands or products. It's all about getting the right solution for the customer.
Right, okay.
And again, speaking to the customer, it's about making them aware of the other solutions that are available. So again, one of the biggest ones currently is the energy efficiency. Mm-hmm. So, you know, putting these case studies together, saying, look, you're using this fryer, you're cooking this amount of food, it's currently costing you X. If you swap to this particular fryer, it's going to be maybe £500 more expensive. However, you'll see that back just in energy savings in the first 6 months, 12 months, whatever that may be.
Yeah.
And it's putting those numbers on paper and showing them in pounds and pence what it means. If you say, I'll save you 20% energy, they go, great, sounds amazing. You say, I'll save you 10 grand, they go, oh, start listening then. So it's putting it into a sort of layman's terms.
So it's meaningful.
Exactly that. Exactly that.
So, I mean, let's be honest. Is there any bit of kit that you're obsessed with? If you had a kitchen or in your kitchen or...
So it's obviously talking about technology and this sort of ties in with Gary here today. But one of my favourite ways of cooking is solid fuel cooking, so over coals. So there's a lot of manufacturers out there that produce these sort of style of ovens, which do that. You know, our own brand Buffalo have just launched one, which is a sort of an entry level, but solid fuel oven where you can fill it with coal, set fire to it, and you're cooking literally like man intended back in the day. You know, so we're taking away all the technology, all the electronics, nothing. It's just flame, fire, and steak, and then we're happy. So that's my sort of favorite.
You like that? Yeah, yeah.
I just think the flavor and stuff. You try and mimic it using, you know, wood pellets and stuff like that, and maybe liquid smokes and stuff. But yeah, to me, I think there's no better way than cooking these style of products on that style
on
of
that
cooking,
shop,
and it just it's such a unique flavor and taste.
And it's very much rising at the moment. That sort of live theatre cooking, that flame, you know, that whole people are wanting that experience more than just
definitely the theatre side of it. I mean, the top restaurants in Bristol, you know, they're using this style of cooking, and it just goes to show it's, you know, whether it's a fad, whether it's going around in big circles and it's going to change to something else in the future. You know, accelerated cooking is obviously a big buzzword, and air frying is a big buzzword currently, but for me, the flavour and stuff you get, you know, don't have to just be meats. Of course, we've done sides in it, we've done desserts in it for the events and stuff, and it's just the best way to cook.
And can't ever you say it, but is there any bit of kit you'd like to see the end of in the market?
I guess in a catering world, there's a few that are just more limited, shall we say.
Yeah.
So things like underpowered induction stuff, because people see the word induction and they sort of think, ah, it's going to be energy saving, it's going to be amazing, it's going to be really quick. But it's understanding the technology. So yes, it will be quick if you've got power behind it and you've got the right pan, you've got a good magnetic pan that's going to do the job. A lot of the weaker products, things like 13 amp powered induction woks, wok zones and stuff like that, induction fryers, tabletop ones, they don't tend to be very good, shall we say, because people will just buy off that buzzword and not understand.
They have an application, but not maybe...
Exactly, it doesn't sort of follow through, and they think, I'll buy this induction fryer and it's going to be as good as my tank fryer, which is gas-powered, and it's just not.
Yes, yeah, it's not possible.
No, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So, it's just understanding it, and that's where we come in. So.
Okay. And just a couple of personal questions, if it's okay, because we've
wrapped
up this part of the podcast.
No problem.
Any, do you cook at home much, or...?
I mean, my wife would tell me no, but I do. But the trouble is, I think it's a chef thing. You can't not do it properly. Like throwing stuff in the oven at night and maybe some, you know, turkey Twizzlers or whatever isn't quite the way to
doesn't
do it.
It for you.
She's like, if you're doing Sunday roast, why'd you take so long doing it? It's because you just have to do it properly. I think if you're going to make the effort, just do it right. So I do, but I tend to cook if you've got, you know, friends coming over or doing a Sunday roast
or something,
or something like that. Exactly, I'll do it then. But the day-to-day stuff, she's
very
good.
And what's your kind of go-to? What do you like to cook?
So, again, it's going to be solid fuel cooking. So I love doing a barbecue. So not just, your burgers and stuff, but doing, like, nice cuts of meat, doing some lovely smoked salads and stuff to go with it, doing some desserts as well. And I just think, I think for putting like a buffet style barbecue is great for guests and dining and stuff, because you can just, you know, people can pick what they want, sit down and chat, and it's just a great way to just communicate and have good times.
Weather's great for it at the minute, so
It's not so good in the winter, so that's where a good curry comes into it, but for now we're using as much charcoal as possible while we're getting away with it.
Exactly. Well, Chris, thank you for that. And obviously, thank you for your insight into your career into Nisbets. We're going to take a short break and then we're going to speak to Gary. And then, if it's okay, you're going to join us at the end.
Yeah, absolutely. No problem.
Great. Okay.
Yeah, cheers.
So now I'm going to be joined by Gary Allett, who's the National Sales Manager for Williams Refrigeration. He specialises in lots of things, including the cold rooms. Gary, it's great to have you here at the show. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. And thank you for inviting us.
No problem. I hope you're happy with the room. I've got this cold setting, as I said to Chris. So
It's very cold. So very apt.
I noticed in this studio, it's either one extreme, where either boiling or it's freezing. So
I prefer this.
Yeah, we've got cold today. Gary, just for the listeners and everything, do you want just, again, sort of, history into your career, how you got into food service equipment, Williams, etc. And
sure. So my real first I'd had a few sales jobs and things, and then I started with a company, and my first introduction into sort of hospitality was more on the sort of chemical and cleaning side of business. So we'd supply a lot of pubs, restaurants, along with industrial people as well, but with more with cleaning chemicals and disposables and you know, the napkin sides and all that type of thing, rather than thing. And then after about 5 years, I moved to another company, and they were more geared into the actual catering trade. So we're very pub-led, and they dabbled with equipment and things as well. And over a period, we built that up, and we built up the equipment side and the project in. So I ended up was installing full kitchens and bars and, you know, around the country.
Right.
And then, and this went on. And that was really good. And we were doing a lot with Falcon Food Service. And because of the synergy between the Williams and Falcon, I got a knock on my door from Williams saying, well, okay, you know, you should deal with us as well, because we're a sister company. This is what we do.
Yeah.
And I said, well, actually, I've got an opportunity with Cold Rooms. Not really stuck on one particular supplier, so you know, let's give it a go.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that, and they had a regional. The company was based in Hull. They had a regional office in Doncaster, so that's still there, and we dealt there, and they came out, and it was a joy.
Right, okay.
You know, so my experience, my first experience of Williams was as a customer, and
yeah.
From the site service, the knowledge that the people had, and the expertise, and looking after and. As a sales project manager, you could sort of forget about the cold room because I knew that was going to be okay.
Yeah.
And I could focus on other areas of the job that was going on where I knew that might need a little bit more care. And it just gave you that real confidence in the product. So that went on for a few years. We built, and then we started specifying the cabinets as well. So the relationship grew that way as the business did. And eventually, I was curious, so I was looking maybe to move to do something a little bit different within the same side of the business, really. And I got asked to consider a job with Williams.
Okay. And how long ago was that?
So that was just over 18 years ago.
Oh, bloody hell.
Yeah. Yeah. So it came in. So I started on the as an area manager. So I looked after the North East and East Midlands. So theoretically from Scotland down to Leicestershire.
Okay.
More realistically, probably a little bit above Newcastle, because a lot of grass sort of above there. And I looked after all the dealers on the east side of the country, which was great. Thoroughly enjoyed the role and the company. And it was great because I knew the guys that were in Cold Rooms, so my relationship with our group offices in the Cold Rooms was already there. So that was a real help and benefit. And it was good to be able to talk to people about Cold Rooms, knowing that I'd bought it myself.
Yes.
So, you know, I'd bought into it, I understood it, I knew, you know, these guys would look after you. So it gives you confidence, and as anybody, you know, you sell what you know and what you trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was really useful. And that went on. And then I got asked to get involved with retail. So there was an opportunity with a major supermarket that we might or may not win the business, and we did, and that was on the bakery side. So still cold room panels, but Durrett had approvers started. So in that way, that one went on, and I then started to look after a few more nationals on that side with retail and pub groups and things as well. And I did that for 3-4 years, still keeping an element of the area, so the customers as well. And then it came to a point, Malcolm asked me, Malcolm Harley, if I'd like to step up and look after the sales team, which is what I do now, which would have been, I think, about seven or so years ago.
Yes.
So I look after the guys around the country and the retail as well.
Okay.
So we look after all that. So it's been a journey. Yeah. And seeing the difference.
So not just specialising cold rooms, it's basically looking after the sales team and then also all the products and everything within the portfolio.
The whole thing, yeah. So you see it all. And it's great because you get to meet, you know, people from all over the country now. So and the area was great.
How big is the sales team at Williams?
So we have Scotland, then we have North East, North West, South East, South West.
Okay.
We have Ireland. And then we have BDM, sort of national accounts, and also we have a guy who looks after retail as well.
So, yeah, quite a big team.
Yeah, and the east of England. Sorry, I missed that one.
Okay.
Sorry, Jonathan.
So, I mean, today we're here talking about cold rooms. And obviously Williams does lots of things, not just cold rooms and meat, and obviously we talked about meat ages as well. So, I mean, a cold room, to me, I'm going to probably shoot me, but is it just a big fridge? But is it a big fridge or what is it? I mean
that is what you're always fighting against. That it's a big white box that gets cold.
Yeah,
and that's what you fight against. And it's not, or it shouldn't be.
Right.
And so we make a cold room. So sort of unique things about Williams. Everything's cam locked. So the floor to the walls, the ceiling to the walls to the wall. So it's fully cam locked. So it goes together like a kit.
Okay.
But what that does, it creates a really strong thermal seal.
Okay.
So you keep in that, you're keeping the temperature in there. Yes. So there's no temperature ingress. So that's really important. And then we have 90 mil panels.
Yeah.
So people look at, oh, it's a box, they get cold. How thick are the panels? Is it, how good is it insulated? Well, ours are all 90 mil, so whether it's chilled or it's frozen, then it's the fine. It's the same. You don't need, that's a freezer, I need to put thicker panels in.
Okay.
You don't, it's going to work out of the way.
Right, okay. Which standardizes it, makes it.
And obviously it makes it easy for, not just for us in terms of manufacture, but for people designing or people putting in, that they know exactly what they're going to get. They know what the sizes are from the off.
I mean, it's quite a key part of the kitchen, but I mean, when we talk to chefs, maybe they're not so interested in it. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, people are always obsessed about the cooking equipment.
Yeah.
And the hungries and then the dishwashing and the fridges.
Absolutely. Which is, again, a bit strange when you understand the subject more, because the only product within that kitchen that's on 24/7, 365 days a year, is the refrigeration.
Yeah.
It probably gets the least amount of thought, because the really fancy cooker that's got whistles and bells on it is like much more exciting. And I get that. But, you know, and if you look at the value.
Until the fridge goes down.
Exactly. Yeah. Until it goes down. And then it's really important.
Yeah.
We always fight about that. We always say it's a box that gets cold. Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, we talk about cold rooms and that kind of thing. What's the key things around installing and planning of a cold room, if you like?
I'd say the biggest would be positioning an airflow. So we get a lot where, and probably in an area where we are now in Canary Wharf, with many tall buildings, we'll have a cold room there and we'll put the plant on the 50th floor. And that's...
and they probably don't agree, on the ground.
And they don't know why it's a bad idea.
Right, okay.
And obviously the further away the equipment is, then the bigger that equipment's going to be, the more expensive it's going to be, the more refrigerant you're using, so the less green that is.
Okay.
And the whole thing.
More cost to run,
cost to buy, I mean, everything. So it's, but it happens a lot, and I think it happens a lot. So architects will look at it as you would with air conditioning. And there's not an issue with air conditioning going up massive heights and coming down, but because it goes both ways because of the hot and cold.
Okay.
Whereas a fridge is just cold, so it creates a lot of complications doing that. So that would be one. And then positioning. So it's, well, we've got a plant room and we've got a louver in the door. Mm-hmm. And that's great. So there's some air coming in the louver, but is it enough air? How do you get rid of the hot air and things? So it's always about that, you know. You can put integral units in, and that's fine if you've got the space and the airflow to do it. But you've got to realise you're putting a 2-3 kilowatt heater into that kitchen. You know, you're going to increase the heat. That affects everything.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's probably not understanding what's actually happening, as opposed to... And again, it comes back to when I was in cold rooms and I first started speaking to Williams, I had the guys there that... This is what... We should move that to there because this is going to make a big difference.
Yeah,
I know you want to put that on the fourth floor, but if you move it out to that bin store, one, you're going to save an awful lot of money to start with. It's going to work better. It's going to be more efficient. It makes sense.
I mean, in London, I guess we see a lot of the condenser things in the basement
and,
you know.
And that can be done as long as you're bringing air in and air out, then absolutely fine. But it's where people... think a louver's an airflow.
Yeah, I get that. And so what makes Williams stand out really against the competitors in the market?
Well, as I mentioned about the cam lock, and that's quite unique in terms of what they do. So it's not cut and shut, so you know, you don't need you get a full seal with that. With that, it can all, you know, it means if need be you could take it down and move it. And we've had that as well,
right?
So we do that. We do internal rooms, external rooms, so as well. So the variety of what we can do and the different applications is through. It's not just a one box with a few sizes. You know, you can go from a very small room to to something that's outside.
Yeah.
And the different applications as well. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, from what I've seen, and oh, at different manufacturers and things, but the expertise and the sort of knowledge is strong with Williams Cold Rooms.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've found that. Yeah. And also the professional approach, if you're working like in a live environment.
Yeah.
Are sensitive projects, and they're just very professional and polite and conduct themselves appropriately.
Well,
no cigarettes so. In the Logan Bay. So.
That's always the intention. I hope that's always the case, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's something that I've noticed. So obviously energy at the moment, well, it's a big subject, energy costs.
Absolutely.
I think it's not going to go away. What innovations are you seeing that are going to help reduce those costs?
It's something that we're always working on. So it comes down to the equipment, so that buying the most energy efficient pieces. And not just cold rooms, across all of our range. We're constantly looking at, will this condenser work better than that condenser? Will this EC fan work better than something else? And the whole thing. And then about refrigerants. So there's you talk about energy efficiency, but people are very mindful now in terms of the green effect and that of refrigerants. So, you know, we're working now on A2Ls and that's a solution there. When I touched on bakery earlier, we've just developed a new retard approver for a major supermarket. And that runs on natural refrigerants, so R290.
Right.
So again, global warming potential 3.
Yeah.
So bringing those things down. So it's not one thing. It's the whole picture. Wrap of things. And that's something that's ever since I've been at work, that's always been the case. It's not like just the last few years that we've started looking at those things. It's always been the case. It's more
prominent.
On vogue now. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Something you've been doing for ages. Yeah. And there's different types of rooms and cabinets.
Yeah, I mean, massively. So we did probably with some of the strangest ones. So we did a room up in Scotland, and it's for saplings, for trees.
Okay.
So this room runs at -3 degrees and 3 degrees. It switches
right
between the two, and I'm not sure the time scale. And when it's in positive temperature or plus, it also controls the humidity. So we had humidity, and it's so that these saplings grow. And it's huge rooms. They have these rolled doors. So as a forklift comes up, they come up, and once they've gone through, they slam closed to keep the temperature. The value is huge. So it has huge backup systems.
Right.
They have a freezer room that's like a library. So it's racked out like a library, and it's all seeds, and they're all frozen.
Wow.
And they're worth over £2 million.
Wow.
So again, you know, you have a backup system. So if one
and
fails,
what are the trees for
the UK.
Okay, they're cultivating them there.
Yeah, yeah, they're cultivating them. Yeah, so they have like a library of tree seeds that are held frozen.
Wow.
And so, yeah, I mean, that's like, but I think, well, that's a bit strange. We've done for a police department, we did a biological evidence room. Mm-hmm. I don't want to consider what goes in there, but it needs to be kept at the right temperature.
Yeah, of course.
So with those, so you know, you get things like that. And obviously, I've mentioned exterior rooms and different temperatures. And probably the most exciting, the one that we do the most now, and when I think you talked earlier about, well, is it just a box that gets cold?
Mm-hmm.
And what we do a lot of now is more the front of house rooms. So whether that be fish or charcuterie, and probably the main one, which would be meat aging.
Yes.
So I think Chris mentioned restaurant in Bristol, and we've done one there, and a few others as well, where they have a whole side of the room is a window.
Yeah.
So you can see all the strip loins and the fore ribs and the bone and sirloins.
Okay.
All on the course, in view in the restaurant, and that's and on the back of, and we've done that for quite a few years, and on the back of that is why we developed the actual cabinet as well. So people see that and think, well, I haven't got space for that, but
I have a cabinet.
I have a cabinet.
Yeah.
And that's probably where we, myself and Chris, link together the most is around that, yeah.
Also ties into Chris's story about the char grill.
Absolutely. And some of the events that they have there.
That
we do. So, yeah, we'll fill it full of meat and Chris kindly cooks it for us.
And just a quick personal question before we move to the last bit of this podcast. Do you cook at home? I mean,
I do. I'm probably the main cook at home.
Oh, are you?
At home. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm away from home fairly regularly, but when I'm at home, then I cook. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What sort of things you like cooking?
Um, A little bit like Chris, I love barbecuing.
Right, okay.
Absolutely love it. Yeah. What you want, like, I've got a gas barbecue.
Me too.
It's a really good one, but it is a gas one. He shakes his head.
I haven't got time to do that, all that. I haven't got the patience either.
No, but it is a gas. But I do love cooking outdoors.
Okay.
So I'd love that. And but other than that, yeah, again, I think we mentioned, I've got an air fryer, and I love that as well. So that's, but yeah, no, I do enjoy cooking. It's my sort of like, I'll come in and that's my sort of hour where I can just chill. And
yeah.
So I do enjoy that.
Well, Gary, thank you for that and the insight into Williams. We're going to just take a short moment, then Chris is going to rejoin us. We'll have a bit of a round table if that's okay.
Yep, yeah, great.
Cool, okay.
Welcome to the world of Ali, the largest and most diverse food service equipment company on the planet. With over 110 brands under the Ali Group umbrella, we serve more than 150 countries worldwide. Our brands are at the forefront of innovation, offering cutting-edge technology and ergonomic designs that keep pace with the ever-evolving market. But we're not just a global leader, we're a network of local companies working together to deliver excellence. Ali Group's unmatched expertise in food service makes us the proud exclusive sponsor of Kitchen Curiosity. To learn more, visit aligroup.com.
So now I'm rejoined by Chris and Gary, and we're going to get into a bit of a round table discussion. We're going to talk about cold room refrigeration. We're also going to talk generally about food service equipment and then get their insight as well as how they feel the market's going to be in the next sort of three to five years. So, Chris, Gary, welcome back.
Thank you.
So you worked together, I think, at the NCEC, is that right? Am I saying that right?
Yeah, so obviously we work closely with Williams. We get obviously customers coming into the NCEC, everything from an independent to a large chain. So as I say, there's always, every piece of equipment is right for a certain customer. It's just finding that piece of equipment for that right customer. And of course, Williams has a massive catalogue of equipment that's available and really good quality. So certainly when it comes to meat aging, it seems to be our big tie at the minute because it seems to be quite an apt, you know, my sort of favourite way of cooking. Plus they've got the meat ager, so it works in harmony. I mean, Gary brings me lots of meat and I cook it and eat it. I mean, what a perfect relationship.
Okay.
that's the one. Yeah. I think, as I say, we've had the whole sales team down in this bit. So so we could explain to them the difference in meat aging. Because we can develop a cabinet or a cold room or anything that does something a little bit different. And as a sales team, you don't naturally see that. You don't see it in action. You know, we see it in a warehouse.
I mean, what's the big difference then between this meat aging and say a normal fridge?
Temperature wise, it's different. So you'd run between sort of 1 and 6.
Yeah.
And then what we do is we control humidity via Himalayan salt blocks.
Okay.
So that adds flavour. It also inhibits bacterial growth.
Okay.
So we developed it with craft butchers.
Okay.
Master butchers. So over a period, and as we've done so. As I say, it flavours the meat. It also, obviously, you see it dry and you see that crisp on the outside. But it flavours it. The enzymes break down the tissue, so it becomes more
tender
and things. So you get a real taste. So understanding that side of it and controlling that humidity, what you do, it's a real art, really. And you see the, you know, the top butcher, and we put these into, you know, Michelin star chefs. Recently, we've done some of that are doing different products as well. So as opposed to just meat, but with poultry and even vegetables. They talk about, I think so.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. So how it changes, I've not experienced. So
it's a different, an age, is it a different cabinet for a different application then, or could sometimes be the same.
It's based around a standard cabinet, but it's then adapted.
Okay, so depending on the filters in.
Yeah, so the same cabinet for the different products, sorry.
Yeah.
To what you said. Mm. Yeah, so different, the same cabinet for that. And it's just the way that you would treat it. So, I mean, I don't know what our record is for how long we've had
I think when we did an event, didn't we? We did a sort of taste the difference type, where we did normal 28-day aged, which we just, as I say, got from the shop around the corner. Right. And then we aged a couple of four ribs for over 100 days. Yeah. And
you had them in there?
Yeah, yeah. Broke them down then after into steaks and then cooked them off. And what we did then, we did a blind tasting test where we had, I think it was about 18 to 20-ish people in the room. And I cooked two different types of steak, but I also cooked one on a gas grill, one on an electric grill, and one on the traditional charcoal grill. Put all the steaks out and hid it all, so nobody knew what was what, and then everybody had to say which one was their favorite and why. And I think anonymously everybody chose the aged steak on the charcoal.
Of course.
So it's just
you were aging that for 100 days there's a lot of foresight and planning.
Yes, and a lot of security, because you've got these, you know, we had to move the cabinet into the kitchen because unfortunately somebody tried to get into it and, you know, touch and feel, and so to speak, but luckily the fridge is locked.
Is there a maximum time you can age this stuff for, like safely?
Not necessarily. So in theory, you can age, you know, people that age for over a year and stuff. There is a sweet spot, absolutely. It depends on people's, what flavour they're looking for.
Okay.
I find after around about probably 40-ish to 50 days, then the flavour starts changing quite a lot. And then it's a bit more like a nutty sort of flavour, metallic-y. Okay. And then as you age further and further on, then that flavour becomes more, more prominent.
Is there ever like testing done on this sort of to see what the bacteria is? There bacteria?
There is. So it's very similar to like cheesemakers. It's like a penicillia on the outside. So if you think of like cheese, they make cheese in caves for donkey's years, and they get that seal around the actual product, which then protects the core. And it's very similar to aging meat. So you get that almost looks nasty exterior, which is like this crispy, moldy sort of horrible exterior.
Yeah.
But you think people eat Stilton quite happily. So it's essentially you take off that outside layer and then you're just left with this beautiful broken down deep red meat in the middle.
There's other advantages to it as well. So we put some into a leisure park, and then they're quite an upmarket one, but really, really nice actually. And they age it. But what they do on a Sunday, they do a Sunday lunch for everybody. And he normally buys two or three big sirloins.
Yeah.
And what he'd always done in the past is if he only needed the two, the other one would go in the freezer and he would use it the following week. And what he does now is if he's got anything left, he just puts it in the meat ager. And it's it's not degenerated for the following week. It's actually better.
Better, yeah.
And you're not getting that waste because it's aging, you can use what you need and the rest will age, so you're saving up on waste and things as well. So he started doing that with the trimmings, and so he makes aged burgers and things now, so he adds it to that adds flavour. So there's lots of, once you start getting
some spin-offs to it.
And then
I guess different operators can buy less aged meat and then age it themselves,
and that saves a lot of money as well.
Saves money,
so within you're probably saving sort of £5, £7 a kilo,
seriously.
Because you're not aging it yourself. Or from a butcher's point of view, he's charging.
Storage costs money.
And things. So we did a case study of a butcher up in Staffordshire, and he has four of our meat ages, and he's aged for way over a year and things. And really great. And we did some meat aging courses up at his place, and he has one fridge, and he calls it the reserve, and people pay to have their joint in until they want it. So they may have a wedding or a particular family party due in September. I think, well, in June, I'm going to buy my four rib and keep it in the fridge.
Wow. To have that really, really aged meat.
It's definitely a different flavour profile, and it's beautiful, but there is that sweet spot, and it really depends on the individual to what that sweet spot is. Because when it goes over too far, people go, I like it, I appreciate it, but it's not quite there for me. It's a bit too nutty.
It's too meaty. If people were sort of getting into that meat ageing, chefs and things are sort of thinking, I want to get into that, What kind of advice would you give to them, really?
The first thing is to decide what you're going to do, because certain products tie in with meat aging better. So anything on the bone, for instance, rather than putting one piece of fillet in the fridge.
Yeah.
And then it's down to the cabinet. So one of the questions we've been asked a couple of times, certainly on the recent events with Williams, is could you do a smaller one? Is there a smaller ager available, which you can maybe go on the countertop, because I want to show that my grill house or my steakhouse is doing aged meat? And the simple answer to that is there's not much point, because you need to have the capacity available to be able to age enough to cope with the demand that you need. Otherwise, so you see on most, high-end sort of steakhouses, you'll have maybe a chalkboard or something that says we've got X amount of ribs, we've got X amount of porterhouse, whatever. And the reason for that is you don't want to be going in and out the age all the time. It's not like a fridge where you need to be opening and closing the door. You want to be going in maybe once, twice a day maximum.
Because not change
the atmosphere in the climate within the cabin. Exactly. So if you had, say, a tabletop small aging fridge and you were using it for your steaks, you could maybe get maybe one four rib in there, maybe a couple of tomahawks or whatever, depending on the size of it, but then you'd use that in one service. So no point aging for 24 hours, and then you're just using it as more of an aesthetics thing, so you may as well buy a wine fridge
yeah
and save the money. so the size they've got is a really nice size, so sort of a single upright fridge sort of size, which is perfect for sort of your entry sort of step into aging, because it gives you the capacity to be able to cope with a normal service in a normal grill restaurant.
Yes.
And of course, if you need more space, they can build, well, that's the ones in Bristol, they're pretty much walk-in rooms.
So what you're kind of saying is if you're going to do it, you need to invest
a bit and understand
a proper room.
Yeah, exactly that. And
otherwise, it's a bit pointless.
Exactly. Otherwise, you're just spending money for not reaping the rewards.
Yeah.
It's nice to have the buzzword. I age my own so-and-so, and how I do it in my fridge at home. You need to do it properly if you're going to do it.
Of course, yeah. And Gary, is there any kind of advice that you would give to people who are maybe not just starting, but just generally specifying cold rooms or meat ages and that kind of thing?
I think that the whole thing it is about that location and getting it right.
Right.
Think about where the equipment's going.
Okay.
Don't just think about the box and I can get into that. It's about how is it going to run? What's the best way to do that? And another common thing, people are building a room into a room and they put the walls against the walls, and you should have a 100mm gap around, or at least 50, just so the room doesn't sweat.
Yeah.
So it's just realising, what you do and the application. Do you need to be in and out of it? Are you taking trolleys in?
Yes.
If it needs to have a floor. I mean, for example, you might not have the rooms, or it could be a real trip hazard having a ramp.
Yeah.
But you might need to have a floor. And if it's a chiller and you need to have a floor, we can do them internally as well.
Yeah.
So you're not using that space outside. So there's lots. I think it's really thinking a little bit more about it and getting the right advice at the time of this is what I want to do. And probably around temperature, realise most refrigeration that you buy is storage refrigeration.
Right.
So don't think you can put ambient product in there and that is going to be fine. I mean, an odd little bit every now and again is, but if you stock it full of ambient product, you're going to have a big ice cube on your evaporator, and then apparently it's somebody else's fault that happened.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. Of course.
Actually, go and make a mop out the walk-in freezer.
well, thank you for that. If we're just going to have a quick bit, if you like, a quick fire round of questions for both of you. Quick answers. What's the best dream bit of kit for you in the kitchen, Chris?
Again, I'm going to have to say the solid fuel, Bass grills and stuff like that, because it's just, you can't beat it.
Okay.
I think I'll go Blastula.
Okay, cool, like that. Best overrated gadget?
Eggshell breakers, because they just destroy the eggs. I don't get the point.
Is there such a thing?
There is. You're basically, it's like a little spring-loaded thing, and you slam it on the egg, and it just breaks it every time. So, yeah, useless.
I agree with that. Gary?
I think the one I see is when, people put glass doors onto refrigerators in really hot kitchens so that they don't have to open it to save energy.
Yeah.
Well, you're going to use that much energy just by having a glass door on it.
Of course, exactly. Sort of, it's a bit pointless.
A bit pointless, yeah.
For both of you, strangest thing you've ever seen in the cold room? I mean, we kind of know yours, Gary, but...
It was more of a prank, really, I guess. So one of the large saucepans, we had a chef with us who always used to play... a certain CD that was very annoying. So every time he was in the kitchen, he knew he was in there. So what we did is we got a large saucepan, filled it half full of water, put it in the walk-in freezer, froze it down, and then put the CD in the middle, filled it back up with water again, and then froze it back. So it was right in the middle. So we walked in one day, and it was this massive block of ice with his CD in the middle. So that's probably the strangest thing I've seen.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, I think we're going to have to stick with trees.
Trees.
Yes, yeah.
If you weren't in the industry, what might you be?
So for me, I guess my big sort of hobbies is to do with cars and stuff. So I'd be something technical with that.
Right, okay.
That side of things interests me.
I grew up, I always wanted to be a marine biologist. Wow. I love animals and the sea life and things like that. So, yeah, slightly different selling fridges, but it's it's still good.
Massively different.
Keeping the fish cool now. Just keep it for your life.
Yeah.
Do you have many kind of marine?
No, not really. It's just as a child, it was just a massive interest to me, all that.
Yeah. I've been whale watching like 4 times. I've only ever seen one whale.
I think it probably came from Jack Cousteau or something like that. You know, way back in the day.
And who's fussier, the chef, consultants, manufacturers, dealers?
I guess it depends what you're asking, what we're trying to solve. But I'd always say the consultants are always going to be the more ones. The chef, you know, he's laid back, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go with chef.
Okay. So just kind of looking ahead, if you like, for the next 3 to 5 years of food service equipment industry and then also maybe the wider hospitality, what's your view on that? Where do you see it? What's coming down the road? What are the biggest challenges?
So, for me, I guess I'm seeing a lot more challenges around energy and staff labour. So a lot of more equipment is becoming more automated, whereby you program it by a chef or a group chef who will then have operators to use that said equipment, because an operator is going to be a cheaper alternative and more readily available than a chef. Okay. So that's a big change I've seen, and a lot more questions around energy, certainly from the larger chains. That's now a focus point, because when you say putting it back into pounds and pence, these numbers start adding up when you're looking at large groups. So that's where I see it going, is more automated, and then a bigger gap between a chef slash head chef, group chef, whatever, versus an operator, and that gap becoming more divided, whereby you'll have maybe a central production kitchen or a main kitchen for a group, and then that food will be discarded out to satellite kitchens or across the range. Someone's brain is going to go into the equipment. The chef who's developing all these amazing recipes for their restaurant is going to go into the equipment, and then that could be linked through electronically via Wi-Fi or very cloud-based technologies, and that then information is on the said piece of equipment. So all the operator has to do is get that piece of whatever they're cooking, put it into the machine, and then just say cook option one or cook steak, and it will do it for you because it's been developed in the background. And that's where I see it going, unfortunately.
Yeah, especially on the bigger groups, and we're standardizing it, I guess, and ensuring quality.
Yeah, and people want standardized. You know, we want to go, you know, we go to a site down in, I don't know, Cornwall, and you go to one in Edinburgh, and if it's the same group, you expect to have the same meal. You need to understand those levels. You know, when it comes to independence, that's a bit different, because you can be a lot more creative. And I think those core skills are slowly dying out.
Yeah,
because people don't do the bread making anymore, because it's cheaper and easier to go and buy it from a baker. Whereas, you know, we used to make the bread from scratch in the morning, all the rolls and stuff like that, and it'd be made, so we have that core skill.
Yeah.
But now, because by the time you buy the ingredients and pay the labour to do it, you can just buy it from a baker for a quarter of the price.
Yes, people, and might be better.
Exactly. So it's consistent, it's going to be made in an oven. Bakery's going to have walk-in ovens and rack ovens and so on, whereas in the kitchen, you're going to be put it all through technically maybe one or two combis, which, don't get me wrong, do a very, very good job. But if you've got an oven specified for that particular task, then that's going to do a notoriously a better job.
So, better job, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, what's your kind of...
Well, I'd agree with Chris on that. So we recently developed a new retired approver, and that has an interface, a controller that's pictorial.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to prove bread, you can have a picture of that bread, so there's no thought of what temperature, humidity do I need to put that. I just press the right picture.
Yeah.
Does that so we do see that. I think flexibility of equipment is becoming more and more. So that is something that we're working on. So where you get variable temps, so sometimes it's a fridge or it's in between, or a freezer. And in between that, across more equipment. I know we have it more now with drawers, and you see fairly common in drawers, but I think on other equipment as well, that you'll have that flexibility that gives you that, if you're changing menus or any other thing, it just gives you that flexibility to do that. So I think we'll see more of that. The energy efficiency is always a thing. I think in refrigeration, we get that more than most, because we've been subject to the MEPs since 2016. So in terms of driving that energy efficiency, we've recently just launched our latest, what we call our R4 versions, which hit the high point across the industry in terms of our counters and things. And then more now, we're getting involved with sort of embodied carbon and having to look at those. So where's everything coming from? What's it cost in terms of actually to make the product, but then actually, you know, through the lifetime of that product. So that's becoming more. And we're hearing more and more about that from different, so sometimes from consultants, but from the big construction firms. Yeah. You know, we're getting that a lot. So that's is something that we're working towards a solution, and we're well on with that. But yeah, it all adds extra challenges to the business.
I might say that in your sector, you were one of the first to have the ratings of
the ATG.
Commercial equipment.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So that's
an ABC, that kind of thing.
And that's great. So we always, as I said, we relaunched our counters recently, and they become the best on the market. And we understand that that's a moment in time.
Yeah.
Because then our competitors will do the same thing, and they'll go.
Of course.
And then we'll go again. And the whole point of it is, I mean, the regulator sets it up so that all the top manufacturers are vying with each other to produce the most efficient products. And that's good for everybody, isn't it? So we've been in that world for quite a number of years now, in terms of refrigeration. But it's quite unique to, on the commercial side.
On the commercial side,
Not on the domestic side.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, when did that come around, that? How long has it been around, do you know?
Well, on the professional refrigeration, it's 2016.
So it's almost a decade.
Yeah, and then display refrigeration, 2021.
Right. Okay.
So then you get a different classification.
So in terms of food service equipment market, your sector's ahead really on that.
Yeah, yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Compared to other sectors within the equipment sector, if that makes sense, yeah.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
Okay, well, any kind of final thoughts from you, Chris, before we just wrap this part of the podcast up?
No, I guess thanks for the opportunity to come down and chat to you guys and Gary as well. So, yeah, thank you for your time.
Cool. Well, yeah, thank you for joining us, and I hope it's been okay.
It's been great.
Gary, any comments you want to make for us? Or
No. I'd echo what Chris said. Thank you for the invitation. It's been good. Nice cool room as well.
Yeah.
which helps. So no, thank you very much.
I guess if you're ever in Bristol next, come down for some aged steak and we'll cook it off you.
Yeah, yeah. How do we find out about that? That's probably a good thing to just pick up on that.
So we do events at the NCC. So the best thing to do is to look on the NCC website, and all the events are listed there with the times and dates and a bit of...
So just Google Nisbets.
Yeah, and so Nisbets, if you go to nisbets.co.uk, on there you'll have a tab which says the NCC, or you can just Google straight to the NCC, and then on there will be the events page and all of them listed in there.
Okay.
So yeah, we'll be doing more events in the future with Williams, I'm sure. So it'd be good to get people down and really try before you buy it.
Definitely. Well, thank you both for joining me here today, and I hope it's been okay. It's been interesting listening to both of your stories and finding out about, obviously, Nisbets and a bit more about Williams. Well, that certainly gives us a lot to think about from a design process, the daily operators, a lot of information there about meat aging as well, which is something quite interesting, and maybe puts a different slight spin on cold rooms, etc. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. If you have time, subscribe to follow us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you've got a moment, send us a comment or rate the podcast. Any questions, email me at radford@kitchencuriosity.co.uk. On the next episode, we're heading out to Sweden, where we're talking to a manufacturer of one of the most eco-friendly dishwashers in the market. And also coming up later in the season, we've obviously got Milan Host coming up later in the autumn. Until next time, stay curious, keep it cool, and don't underestimate the power of a cold room.
Kitchen Curiosity is written and hosted by Radford Chancellor and is edited and produced by Tom Anderson. Kitchen Curiosity is exclusively sponsored by Ali Group and is a Sound Rebel production.